Good evening. Pelosi calls the GOP police reform bill murder, waiting for a major abortion decision by the Supreme Court, and the occupation of a plaza outside City Hall enters a third day. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Thursday, June 25th, 2020. And the governor of Texas is backtracking on his plan to reopen the state as the daily number of new coronavirus cases across the United States peaks. Republican Greg Abbott, whose state was among the first to reopen, paused any further steps and reimposed the ban on elective surgeries to preserve hospital space after the number of patients statewide more than doubled in 2 weeks. In Arizona, a record 415 patients were on ventilators, with 23% of tests for coronavirus coming in positive, triple last week's number. And Nevada's governor ordered the wearing of face masks in public as the United States recorded 34,500 COVID-19 cases on Wednesday. The disease seems to be spreading among younger adult victims. On a positive note, deaths from COVID-19 are down, although experts warn that may be a result of a lag between getting the disease and contracting the most serious symptoms. The virus has been blamed for over 122,000 U.S. deaths, the world's highest toll, and more than 2.3 million confirmed infections nationwide. And President Trump continues his campaign swing through states he desperately needs if he's going to win re-election in November. After a disappointing show in Tulsa, where an auditorium was barely a third full, he spoke Tuesday in Phoenix to 3,000 young Republican supporters who gave him an enthusiastic welcome as they crowded into the hall without face masks. Trump also announced an Independence Day rally on July 4th at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota, where the busts of four presidents were carved into a mountain 79 years ago. The monument, featuring Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, and Theodore Roosevelt, is considered a desecration of sacred Native American lands by many Lakota people, who consider the Black Hills wrongfully taken in violation of treaties signed by the U.S. government. Several Native groups say they'll be there to protest Trump's appearance. A member of the Oglala Lakota tribe says Mount Rushmore is a symbol of white supremacy, of structural racism that's still alive and well in society today. The sculptor of the monument, Gutzon Borglum, was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, according to historians. And a New York City judge on Thursday dismissed a claim by Donald Trump's brother that sought to halt the publication of a tell-all book by the president's niece, saying the court lacked jurisdiction in the case. Titled Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, the author is Mary Trump, the daughter of Fred Trump Jr., the president's elder brother, who died in 1981. A promotional blurb for the book says it reveals a nightmare of traumas, destructive relationships, and a tragic combination of neglect and abuse. In Washington, Senate Democrats on Wednesday blocked police reform legislation led by South Carolina Senator Tim Scott, the only black Republican senator. Democrats have repeatedly criticized the bill as inadequate, and Republicans had refused to negotiate over the measure before a procedural vote. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi declined to apologize for her attack on the bill during a CBS News radio interview, calling GOP tactics akin to murder.
So far, they were trying to get away with murder, actually, the murder of George Floyd.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi. The House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said he was outraged by Pelosi's remarks.
She said Republicans are trying to get away with murder, the murder of George Floyd. Tim Scott has not been working on this bill just for 1 month. This has been a life passion of Tim, with his own personal life experience. That's why he found his success when opportunity zones are funding of black colleges. Her words are reprehensible. This is actually a new low for Speaker Pelosi when it comes to just trying to score points with her newly radical base. Think for one moment. This is the Speaker of the House of Representatives. The job of Speaker is too big for words so small. Does anyone in her conference stand by her on these words?
The House Minority Leader, Kevin McCarthy. And the United States Supreme Court is expected to announce a key decision affecting a woman's right to choose within the next 2 weeks. The case, titled June Medical Services, concerns a Louisiana law requiring abortion care providers to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, widely considered an onerous and unnecessary requirement aimed at reducing access to abortion services. The law is almost identical to a Texas statute that was struck down by the court in 2016. The difference, two conservative justices appointed by President Trump, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh. While the law doesn't directly threaten the landmark Roe v. Wade decision that guarantees a right to choose, it may portend further state regulation of abortion. A law professor at Columbia University is Carol Sanger. She says the case is about whether the court will respect the rights of women.
The substance of the law is that every abortion provider in the state of Louisiana must get what are called admitting privileges to a hospital within 30 miles of the healthcare clinic. So this was exactly what the court dealt with in the Texas case, which was called Whole Women's Health. The court was very clear that this was unconstitutional to require admitting privileges for abortion providers in hospitals within such a short distance from the clinic. The Texas governor said, when court was viewing its law, this is just a way for us to close down abortion clinics. Now, Louisiana has added one other justification for its admitting privileges law. It is a way of double checking the certification of the doctor. It's not true because doctors already have medical licenses. The real purpose of the law is to close clinics and make abortion impossible to get in the particular state. Abortion providers don't use hospitals regularly. They don't admit patients to hospitals because the procedure is so safe. So it's hard for an abortion provider to get admitting privileges because they don't have the record of hospital use that hospitals like a doctor to have before they dole out these special privileges.
In the Supreme Court, briefly, explain to us, what's the lay of the land there? What's going to happen there, in your opinion?
It's a very hard question. The key issue is this, are admitting privileges statutes constitutional or not? And the rule right now for whether a statute is constitutional or unconstitutional, the unconstitutional rule is, does the regulation put a substantial obstacle in the place of a woman seeking an abortion? And the June Medical Services argues, well, this puts a huge obstacle because it means clinics will close. What the state argues against that is, this is constitutional because it's for the benefit of women by further credentialing doctors.
Okay, the guy at the middle of this is John Roberts. He's the one who's not, people aren't for sure what he's going to do. What do you think he's going to do?
I think he's going to find it unconstitutional because people have been saying for a while he doesn't want to be the chief justice whose court overturns Roe. Now, this case will not overturn Roe. This is about one particular kind of legislation. But if he were to uphold the Louisiana law, it would be a signal that states can start over-regulating abortion again. That would put a lot of abortion providers out of business. There's one other piece about the case that's quite peculiar. The state of Louisiana has argued at oral argument that doctors should not be able to bring cases against legislation on behalf of their patients. And there are several doctors who are plaintiffs in the June medical case. Now, that would be a very new kind of decision. The court has 8 times said, yes, abortion providers, you know, OBs and gynecologists, can represent the interests of their patients in an abortion suit. And the reason is that to bring legislation to the Supreme Court takes way over 9 months, And either because the woman will have had an abortion elsewhere or will have given birth, she can't be the plaintiff because she's not a pregnant woman who wants an abortion anymore. So going back decades, the court has said it is the only way we can test this issue is to let doctors represent the interests of their patients. If the women can't bring them because they're not going to be pregnant during the whole duration of the suit, they can't bring them. And if the doctors can't bring them, then they have the standing means the right to go into court. Mm-hmm. And so you'll have the court will have knocked out the two parties who are the most likely to represent the interests of pregnant women. We have a very peculiar attitude about that.
Peculiar in what way?
You might say if abortion is murder, and a woman wants to terminate her pregnancy, and she goes to a licensed doctor, she's basically hiring a hitman, the doctor, to do the murder for her. I mean, if you take this vocabulary, you know, seriously. But the U.S. legislation has rarely done that. And in the 19th century, the reason they didn't do it was because they said women aren't really making this decision on their own. Some man is forcing them into getting an abortion. Well, in this century, we know that women do want abortions, and they want them for reasons that have been well studied and understood. So it's hard to say that they're just like children and don't know what they're doing. Abortion is something like an open secret. People know that abortions are happening in the U.S., but what we pretend, or what many people pretend, is that they don't know anybody who's having an abortion. What they don't want is to be forced to know that their neighbor, their daughter, their child's teacher has had an abortion by bringing charges against the woman herself. So people don't know how common it is and how actually reasonable the decision is for many women.
Carol Sanger is a law professor at Columbia University. Another Supreme Court decision that may be on tap concerns Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance Jr., who's trying to subpoena President Trump's tax returns and other financial papers as part of an ongoing criminal investigation. A lower court ruled against Trump last fall. The president's lawyers argue the White House has absolute immunity from state criminal investigations while in office. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Mayor Bill de Blasio is welcoming an encampment outside City Hall by protesters demanding $1 billion in cuts to the NYPD.
This is a city that for generations has respected the right of people to peacefully protest, but again, has to be done safely, has to be done with rules that make sense. And so NYPD will address the situation. They're very familiar with how to handle something like this the right way, respect people's rights, but also make sure public safety and other public needs are addressed. They'll work this through as the days go ahead.
About 100 protesters with the group Vocal New York and New York Communities for Change set up an occupation outside City Hall Park off Center Street on Tuesday night. Subway entrances are festooned with the iconic image of George Floyd, whose killing by a Minneapolis police officer on May 25th sparked a protest upsurge against murderous cops that's become a global phenomenon. An activist for Vocal New York is Jawanza Williams.
We are here in our third day of an occupation outside of the Center of Democracy in New York City, City Hall. We want to make sure, as the country is calling to defund the police, and that New Yorkers are here calling to defund the police by at least $1 billion, if not more, or if not total abolishment of the NYPD, because the people that can actually make that a reality work in the building just behind us there at City Hall. That's Mayor Bill de Blasio and Speaker Cory Johnson. And we hear Speaker Cory Johnson's on our side, wants to see that reduction of at least $1 billion and reinvested in housing, healthcare, social services, and education, but the mayor is not so sure. He's not so clear. So apparently we're going to have to build this occupation and expand the number of people here to make sure that he knows that his constituents not only are asking, but demanding that we remember why we're here, that The reason that we are in this space in the first place is because the police continue to maim people. They operate from a culture of annihilation, a culture of violence, a culture of anti-black racism. And if you don't defund the NYPD by at least $1 billion this year, this week, then you don't believe in black lives. You don't believe in the validity of black lives or the suffering that black people continue to experience. And the police and policing itself as an institution has demonstrated for 200 years that they do not create safety for anybody but the elitist, white people, in particular, those with money and property.
Well, you spend billions of dollars on them. Let me look at it that way. Aren't you going to use the service you spent like untold billions on? I mean, we just throw away that money?
Americans in particular, especially white Americans, who have been sort of led to believe in the sort of propagandized reality or the framework of reality that is informed by the capitalist class, by the elitists, who use the institution of policing to maintain their domination on our society. So the only pathways to creating safety that they understand involve policing, which is antithetical to actually creating safety for all communities. So when we invest in ending poverty, in ending homelessness, in providing, you know, comprehensive health care, and that includes mental health care, and that includes evidence-based treatments for substance abuse disorders, these are the modalities that communities have always used, an harm reduction framework, a framework rooted in love and compassion and in dignifying human beings. Like, we need to systematize that kind of approach because we want to go towards an egalitarian society. The reality is everybody really should want a world where there are no police, where we don't need police, because that means we have actual, genuine safety, and your safety has to be built around and defined with the people that are most vulnerable to state-sanctioned violence, to cultural annihilation, centered in your policy and in your culture making. That's black trans people. That's black trans people that use drugs. That's black trans people that use drugs who are experiencing homelessness. We are talking about the most vulnerable people in our society who have the clearest vision, and they've called for the abolition of the police totally. What we're calling here today is the first giant step in that direction in New York City. Let us be the ones to show the world that the way that we actually build and maintain safety for all communities is leaning on those communities themselves to offer up their own solutions, and then we fund those solutions collectively. And it's not rocket science.
The bad apples that you don't know the police guy. You yell and curse at the police, but there's just a few bad apples, and you don't know these people. What right do you have to yell and scream at somebody you don't know?
I think that if people are angry and traumatized and experiencing the collective ancestral trauma of slavery, of enslavement, of the fugitive slave laws, of the police, of where they actually come from, where the institution comes from, because the institution, again, is about culture. It's also about structures. And people are going to respond in a number of ways. And everybody's not going to respond in a way that is deemed respectable within the framework of the society. So I personally don't think that they should risk the safety of the people here, because the police are incredibly dangerous to some people, especially in particular black people. But I'm not going to critique people for expressing their anger. These folks are killing us. The health department just released a report showing that the NYPD have been killing and maiming and harming people and not even reporting that data. But you know what? Black people for hundreds of years have known this is the reality. We didn't need the health department in New York City to tell us that reality. We didn't need the empirical data. We have the experiential data. So we already know what it is. So the way that people express their trauma shows up in all kinds of ways, but we need to actually have the kind of infrastructure, the kind of culture, to be able to offer people meaningful, legitimate ways to address trauma that is caused by these racist, fascist states.
You have support in there, political support?
I think we absolutely have political support, but you know, right now I'm not leaning on those elected officials. They're supposed to represent us, and the body politic is in the park right now speaking. We don't need them. We're articulating our own demands. We're articulating our own vision for the future, our own vision for New York State. And you know what? I think that we have the power to actually do what it's going to take for us to usher in a new era of transformation where actual human beings are centered in our policymaking. Not profit, not corporations, not the police, not white supremacy, white nationalism, or nationalism at all.
Jawanza Williams is an activist with Vocal New York, an artist who claims she's a shaman or a spiritual guide who's providing her services to the encampment is Simone Seraphim. She says she wants to relieve cops of the trauma of violence.
So while everyone's out here expressing themselves vocally and by speaking and sharing and eating and supporting, I'm doing the same by listening and holding space and taking photos and being the bridge and making everybody kind of laugh in between, or at least just admire a beautiful pose or ask a question that no one's thinking about asking. Because as long as people are allowed to express themselves and feel heard, there won't be any need for violence. That's my opinion. Because I feel like if I was a police officer And all I did all day was sit in a car with someone else and hear horrific things come in through the radio, I would have trauma. I would. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's pretty aggressive. Whether it's something silly like, you know, somebody left their bathtub on and now somebody's wet and someone's pissed and now they're arguing, to actual DV situation where someone's getting shot, to a warrant being served incorrectly, to somebody at a gas station getting shot. All these things are relevant. And to deal with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12 things of those a day, that's a big responsibility. That's a big responsibility. And so I feel like everybody needs better care.
You are defunding.
Defunding, I think it's important. I think that if we can't reach the agreement to defund the amount that the people are requesting, at the very least, we should reallocate some of those funds to things that are going to help the police relax. Really relax. Really get therapy. And the people that they've harmed. And I'm not talking about restitution after somebody died. I'm talking about preventing it from the source. So that means putting that money back into the buildings, back into social work, back into making sure we have healthy bodies and healthy minds, whatever way people choose, whether that means going to the hospital to get medication or going to the herbalist to get herbs. Whatever works for somebody is what we need to put the money into. So it's less about the police brutality and more about the war on violence and trauma.
Why do we need a shaman?
Because
it is a shaman.
I'm a spiritual first responder. When your kid says there's a boogeyman under the bed and you don't see it, they probably really do. Or when you get out of a relationship and you feel like there's a curse on you, that's when I show up. And that's real. That's very real. And there are people who believe in it, some people who don't. But I tell you what, if you come sit next to me for a minute, you'll feel it, whether you believe it or not.
Simone Serafim is a shaman at the encampment organized by Defund the Police activists outside City Hall. She spoke with WBAI earlier today. The encampment is expected to last until June 30th when the mayor unveils his 2021 fiscal budget. The city is $9 billion in the hole because of the pandemic. De Blasio says up to 22,000 city workers could be laid off if the federal government doesn't step up with help. The NYPD budget is $6 billion. And finally, in an election marked by a pandemic and mail-in voting, there was no shortage of confusion and problems plaguing polling places across the city on Tuesday. The primary had already been postponed due to the pandemic, and it took a lawsuit to force the state to include the presidential candidates on the ballot. Joe Biden is the presumptive nominee, but candidates Bernie Sanders and Andrew Yang demanded all the candidates be included. For this election, voters had to cast two separate ballots, one for the presidential primary and the other for the state and local races. There were plenty of complaints of missing ballots and confusing rules. One resident, Vera, from NYCHA Houses in Chelsea on Manhattan's West Side, says it took her 10 hours to vote. She was joined by Marnie Halassa, who is a candidate for city council and helped Vera through the maze.
My name is Marnie Halassa. I'm a community activist.
Caller, please. She can introduce herself.
Hi, my name is Vera Naseva. I am a senior at LA Chelsea NYCHA Housing. I have my voting card, and as on the card says, you know, you have your card, so you present your card, and you're done. So, okay, that didn't go that way. They told me I was not on the voting ballot. And I've been voting all these years. And they said, no, you're not, and if you want to go fight in court, or it was really embarrassing, it was really uncomfortable. The people don't know what they're doing, what they're saying. So when I open the paper, the ballot, and then I see that's not what I want to vote for. So I said, no, it should be more ballots for me. And then another one jumped in on me and said, no, this is what we have. I said, no, you don't have another ballot paper, which is, I told the name. They said, no, probably they are different district. We don't have them here. So then I left. I was very upset. So now it's like 10 o'clock.
First, Vera goes to vote, and she is a registered Democrat. She's voted in prior elections as a registered Democrat, and they say she's not a registered Democrat. So then she's like, okay, well, I don't really understand that. So they said to her, okay, you can vote by an affidavit ballot. But when she tried to do that, they even gave her a hard time about her affidavit ballot, which she has the right to. So there was kind of a kerfluffle about voting by affidavit ballot, which is odd. But then when she actually went into the voting booth to vote, there was one page that was missing, and that was the page to vote in the congressional Democratic primary, Jerry Nadler against Lindsey Boylan, and then also the state Senate primary, Brad Hoyleman against Elizabeth Glass. So that whole page was missing. She had an incomplete ballot. So after that, she went out and she said to the poll, the poll workers, hey, listen, you guys, I'm looking. They were like, no, what are you talking about? The ballot's fine. The ballot's fine. So they gave her a problem. They didn't even know that the ballot was incomplete. And then they were giving her a hard time about that. But they also gave her a hard time about her right to vote by the affidavit ballot. 10 hours later and three visits to the poll later, we got this all worked out. But I had to actually talk to the poll supervisor who said, oh, what's going on? And then like 3 minutes later, he said, oh, this has been happening a lot today. It was a crazy process. And then at the same time, they said to her, oh, you know what? If you really want to vote, go get a court order. You can go down to the court and get a court order and come back to vote. And she's like, what? So on every level, it was so confusing. And honestly, it begs the question, like, why are they making it so hard to vote? Is this being done by design? It seems like this is like some kind of voter disenfranchisement, which, as we all well know, does go on. The Republicans may do it in the nation, but also the Democrats do it in New York.
Vera, let me ask you one quick question. Will you vote next election?
Yes. I mean, I believe now it's correct, but I'll see when I get there.
You know what? She's going to have her posse come with her to make sure that she can vote,
Right.
Because she called me and she was in such a state. She's like, Marnie, I tried to vote. I can't vote. She's like, I'm so angry. And Vera got so angry. She was like, oh, you know what? Forget it. I don't even, maybe I shouldn't even vote. But I'm like, no, Vera, you have to vote. So she's like, okay, let's do it. But we were there for like 10 hours later. They screwed up massively. How many more people in District 3 didn't get that second page? Where are the elected officials? Where is Cory Johnson in all this? His constituents are being suppressed and disenfranchised, and you don't hear a peep out of him.
Marnie Halassa, a candidate for city council who helped a voter through a 10-hour ordeal trying to vote in Chelsea on Tuesday. And that's some of the news for Thursday, June 25th, 2020. The news was produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul D'Arienzo.